Chapter 10. Alistair O was just leaving customs when his enemies ambushed him.
Bonjour, uncle.
Ian Cabra appeared on his right.
Have a good flight.
Alistair turned to the left, but Natalie Cabra cut off his escape.
I wouldn't try to get away, Uncle Alistair,
she said sweetly.
It's amazing how many weapons I can carry through an airport.
She held up a China doll in a blue satin dress. Natalie was too old to be carrying something like that, but no doubt she could charm the security guards into thinking otherwise.
What is that?
Alistair asked, trying to stay calm.
A gun? A bomb?
Natalie smiled.
I hope you don't have to find out. It would be quite messy. Keep walking, uncle.
Ian put as much sarcasm into the word as possible.
We don't want to arouse suspicion.
They strode through the terminal. Alistair's heart pounded. He could feel the poor Richard's almanac in his jacket pocket slapping against his chest with every step.
So,
Alistair said,
when did you get in?
Oh, we took our own jet,
Ian said.
We use a private airstrip where the security is much more relaxed. We just thought we'd come welcome you.
How nice,
Alistair said.
But I don't have anything you want.
That's not what we've heard,
Natalie said.
Hand over the book.
Alistair's throat went dry.
How could you possibly know?
News travels fast,
Natalie said.
We have informants. Natalie,
Ian snapped.
I'll do the talking, thank you very much. You hold the doll.
She scowled, which made her face not nearly as pretty.
I can talk if I want to, Ian. Mother and father said, blast what they said, I'm in charge.
Natalie looked ready to yell back at him, but she swallowed her rage. Alistair didn't like the tight grip she was keeping on her doll. He imagined the thing must have a trigger somewhere, and he didn't want to find out what it did.
Surely you don't want another war between our branches, Alistair said, trying to sound diplomatic. One phone call, and I can mobilize help from Tokyo to Rio de Janeiro.
As can we, Ian said. And I've read my family history, Alistair. The last time our branches fought, it didn't go very well for your lot, did it?
Alistair kept walking, thinking hard. A gendarme was standing by a security checkpoint up ahead, about 20 meters. If Alistair could create a distraction.
The 1908 explosion in Siberia, he said to Ian. Yes, that was impressive. But we have more at stake this time.
Exactly, Ian agreed. So hand over the book, old man, before we have to hurt you.
Natalie laughed.
If you could hear yourself, Ian, honestly.
Her brother frowned.
Excuse me?
5 meters to the gendarme, Alistair thought. Stay calm.
Oh, nothing,
Natalie told her brother airily.
Just that you're a terrible bore. Without me, you couldn't even frighten this pathetic old man.
Ian's expression hardened.
I most certainly could, you useless little...
Natalie stepped in front of Alistair, intent on confronting her brother, and Alistair saw his chance. He stepped backwards, then sideways, and before the Cabras could regroup, Alistair was standing next to the gendarme, talking as loudly as he could in French.
Merci, niece and nephew,
he shouted at the Cabras.
But your parents will be worried. Run along now, and tell them I'll be out in a few moments. I have some questions for this officer. I may have forgotten to declare my fresh fruits in customs.
Fresh fruits? The officer said.
Sir, that's very important. Come with me, please.
Alistair shrugged apologetically to the Cabras.
You must excuse me.
Ian's eyes were so angry they looked like they might catch fire, but he managed a stiff smile.
Of course, uncle. Don't worry, we will definitely catch you later.
Come, Natalie,
he said her name through clenched teeth.
We have to talk.
Ow!
She yelped as he gripped her arm, but he herded her down the hallway and out of sight. Alistair sighed with relief. He followed the gendarme gratefully back to customs, where, after 20 minutes of questions and searching bags, Alistair realized, quelle surprise, he did not have any fresh fruit in his luggage after all. He pretended to be a confused old man, and the irritated customs official let him go. Back in the terminal,
Alistair allowed himself a smile. Ian and Natalie Cabra may have been deadly opponents, but they were still children. Alistair would never let himself be outfoxed by youngsters like them, not when his own future and the future of his branch were at stake. He patted the poor Richard's almanac, still safe in his jacket pocket. Alistair doubted any other team knew more about the 39 clues than he did. After all, he'd been spying on Grace for years, learning her purpose. There was still a lot he didn't understand, secrets he hoped Grace had given to her grandchildren. But soon he would find out. He was off to an excellent start. He now understood the true meaning of the first clue, Richard S.'s resolution. He had to chuckle about that. Even Amy and Dan had failed to see what it really meant. He made his way through the terminal, keeping his eyes open for the Cabras, but they seemed to have vanished. He got outside and was dragging his bags toward the taxi stand when a purple van pulled up to the curb. The side door rolled open. A cheerful male voice said,
"Hey there!"
The last thing Alistair O saw was a large fist hurtling toward his face. Chapter 11. After getting through customs at Charles de Gaulle Airport, Amy felt like she'd just lost a fight with a tornado. She'd endured 8 hours on the plane, wedged between Dan and Nellie, who both kept their headphone volume too loud. Dan watched movies, Nellie listened to music and flipped through French cookbooks with full-color pictures of snails and goose livers. Meanwhile, Amy tried to make herself small and read her own books. She'd picked up 6 new ones in Philadelphia, but she'd only managed to finish 1 Benjamin Franklin biography and 2 Paris guidebooks. For her, that was terrible. Every muscle in her body ached. Her hair was a rat's nest. Her clothes smelled like airplane lasagna, which Dan had spilled on her mid-flight. Worst of all, she hadn't gotten any sleep, because the more she read, the more an idea had started to form in her head about Franklin and Paris. And the idea scared her. In the customs line, she was sure she was going to lose it when the official asked about her parents, but she muttered the lie Dan and she had rehearsed, that their parents were coming over on a later flight. Nellie's presence seemed to reassure the official, especially when Nellie started answering his questions in French. The official nodded, stamped their passports, and let them through.
"Nellie," Dan said, "you speak French?"
"Duh. My mom taught French. She was, like, French."
"I thought your family was from Mexico City."
"That's my dad. I grew up trilingual."
"That's amazing," Amy said.
She was really jealous. She wished she knew other languages, but she was hopeless at learning them. She couldn't even remember the colors and numbers from kindergarten Spanish.
"It's no big deal," Nellie assured them. "Once you know 2 languages, learning 3 or 4 or 5 is easy."
Amy wasn't sure if she was serious, but they kept going through customs. They reclaimed their bags, changed their dollars into euros at a kiosk, and straggled onto the main concourse. Amy felt completely lost with all the French signs. Morning light slanted through the windows, though it felt like midnight to her. Down the hall, a crowd was gathering. People were flashing cameras and shouting questions at somebody Amy couldn't see.
"Oh, paparazzi," Nellie said. "Maybe it's like Kanye West."
"Wait,"
Amy said, but Nellie wasn't going to be discouraged. They pushed through the crowd with a lot of excusez-mois. As they got closer, Amy stopped in her tracks.
"Jonah Wizard."
He was wading through the mob, signing autographs, while his dad trailed behind like a bodyguard. Jonah wore baggy jeans, a black leather jacket over a white tank top, and his standard half ton of silver jewelry. He looked fresh and well-rested, like his flight had been a lot better than Amy's.
"Le Wizard!"
The reporters peppered him with questions. To Amy's surprise, Jonah answered them in French. There were so many people, Amy wanted to melt into the walls, but Jonah looked relaxed. He gave the crowd a brilliant smile and said something that made them laugh, then scanned the faces and locked eyes with Amy.
"Yo!"
he called.
"My peeps!"
Amy was mortified. Jonah started pushing his way toward them, and the whole crowd turned to figure out who he was talking to.
"Oh, no way," Nellie said.
"You know Jonah Wizard?"
"We're related to him,"
Dan grumbled.
"Distantly."
Nellie looked like she was going to faint.
Suddenly, Jonah was right in front of them, shaking Amy's hand and patting Dan on the back and signing Nellie's t-shirt, and the cameras started taking pictures of them.
"Don't look at me," Amy wanted to scream. "I'm covered with lasagna."
Her voice didn't work. She tried to back away, but her legs were frozen.
"Jonah," his father said, "we should get going."
"Yeah, sure,"
Jonah winked at Amy.
"Come with, cuz. We got stuff to talk about."
Jonah's dad started to protest, but Jonah put his arm around Amy and steered her through the terminal, with Dan and Nellie and a mob of frantic paparazzi behind them, flashing pictures. Amy was sure she would die from embarrassment any second, but somehow they made it outside. The day was warm and overcast. Storm clouds were gathering on the horizon. A black limousine waited at the curb.
We shouldn't,
Amy started to protest. She remembered Mr. McIntyre's warning, trust no one.
"Are you kidding?" Nellie said. "A limo ride with Jonah Wizard? Come on!"
She practically dove into the limo. A few minutes later, they were gliding down l'autoroute de l'Est toward the heart of Paris.
"Man, I love this town," Jonah said.
His limo had facing back seats. Jonah and his dad sat on one side. Amy, Dan, and Nellie sat on the other. Jonah's dad typed notes on his BlackBerry, every once in a while looking up and scowling at Amy like he couldn't believe she was still there. Outside, rows of gold stone buildings glided by, their windows overflowing with flower boxes. The cafes were crowded with people, all the chairs facing the street like they were waiting for a parade. The air smelled like coffee and baked bread. The cloudy skies gave everything a weird light, as if the city weren't quite real.
"You know, my TV ratings here are even better than in the States," Jonah said.
18 points higher, his dad piped in.
"And my new album, Gangsta Life, is number 3 on the French charts."
"Number 2, his dad said, "and climbing."
"Oh, wow, I love your album," Nellie said.
"Thanks,"
Jonah said. "Now shut up."
Nellie looked like she'd been slapped.
"Hey,"
Dan cried.
"That's not cool."
"What?"
Jonah said.
"She's not a Cahill. I'm not talking to her."
Amy was so shocked she couldn't respond, but Jonah just kept right on bragging.
"Like I was saying, I own this town. My art gallery opened last week on Rue de la Paix. My watercolors are selling for 6,000 euros apiece. I've even got a children's book coming out."
His dad whipped out a copy and showed them. Dan squinted as he read the cover.
Lil Gangsta Livre Instantané?
"That means Little Gangster Pop-Up Book,"
Jonah's dad said proudly. Jonah spread his hands.
"See what I mean? I'm more popular than,"
he smiled slyly,
"Benjamin Franklin."
Something inside Amy snapped. She'd spent several hours reading about Benjamin Franklin, and she was more convinced than ever that he was the most amazing person who ever lived. To think she might be related to him made her so proud. Now to hear this conceited TV star jerk compare himself, she was so angry she forgot to be shy.
Benjamin Franklin was way more important than you, Jonah. He was the most famous American to ever visit Paris. When he came here, people wore his picture on necklaces.
Like this?
Jonah pulled out a Jonah Wizard commemorative photo necklace.
And they wore clothes like his?
Uh-huh. The Jonah Wizard fashion line is doing great on the Champs-Élysées.
Amy gritted her teeth.
King Louis XVI even put Franklin's picture on a chamber pot.
Jonah looked at his dad.
Do we have souvenir chamber pots?
No.
His dad whipped out his phone.
I'll make the call.
Jonah nodded.
So you see, guys, I am the biggest thing since Franklin, which is why I'm the natural person to find his secrets.
If your head was any bigger, Dan muttered, we could use it as a hot air balloon.
Jonah ignored him.
Look, Amy, you're a smart girl. You know the family's got branches, right? Good Cahills, bad Cahills. I'm...
Jonah!
His father covered his phone with his hand.
I thought we discussed...
Dad, chill. All I'm saying, I use my talents to create art. Whatever this final treasure is, I'll use it to bring more beauty to the world. I'm not like those Lucians, man. They're vicious.
Amy's mind was racing.
But Benjamin Franklin was a Lucian. We saw the snake crest.
Okay, so occasionally a Lucian did something right,
Jonah waved his hand dismissively.
But today I'm the good guy. You gotta see that, Amy.
Dan snorted.
Because you make gangster pop-up books? Exactly. Look, you think it was easy for me growing up rich and famous in Beverly Hills?
Jonah paused. Actually, it was easy. The point is, I work hard to stay that way.
Fame is something you gotta keep building, baby. Am I right, Dad?
You're right, son.
I already got albums and TV and fashion and books, so where do I go for up? I'll tell you where. I need to win this contest. It's a smart career move. If we work together, I'll cut you in for a percentage.
Uncle Alistair offered to help us too, Amy grumbled. That didn't work out. Jonah snorted.
Alistair O? That old fool probably told you how he invented microwave burritos, huh? Bet he didn't tell you he lost his fortune on bad investments. He's nearly broke, girl. He should have taken the $1 million and walked, but he's got some crazy idea the 39 clues are gonna restore his reputation. Don't listen to him. You join me, we can beat everybody. We can even show those backstabbers Ian and Natalie. You gotta be careful around here, Amy. Paris is a Lucian stronghold, you know. Has been for centuries.
Jonah, his dad said, you should not be dealing with these people. They have no star power, and they're going to drag down your ratings. Chamberpots, Dad, I'll handle this.
He gave Amy his most dazzling smile.
Come on, girl. We both know the next clue is about Ben Franklin. We could help each other.
What bothered her wasn't that Jonah was an arrogant jerk. What bothered her was that she was tempted by his offer anyway. The idea of showing up Natalie and Ian was hard to resist, and she couldn't help feeling flattered that somebody like Jonah Wizard was paying attention to her. Still, she remembered the way he'd talked to Nellie and how nice he'd been to them at the airport, but it had all been an act, like they were just stage props for the cameras.
Why do you want to deal with us? She asked hesitantly. What makes us so special?
Nothing, Jonah laughed. Isn't that awesome? You're part of the Cahill clan, but you have no talent at all.
Me, if I try to sneak into some place to check out a clue, I'll have the media following me, people shooting my picture and asking me for interviews. I can't do anything in secret. You're so unimportant, you can go places I can't. Nobody cares about you.
Thanks a lot,
Dan grumbled.
What'd I say?
Jonah looked baffled.
Hey, if it's money, I got plenty of that. I can even throw in a day on the set of Who Wants to Be a Gangster. You can't do better than that.
No thanks,
Amy and Dan said together.
Aw, come on. Just think about it, will you? Where's your hotel? I'll drop you off.
Amy was about to make something up when she glanced out the window. What she saw made her blood turn to ice. It was impossible. What was she doing here? And was she really carrying...
Right here, she said. Pull over, please.
The driver did. Jonah looked out the window and frowned. They were parked next to a seedy-looking hotel called the Maison des Gardons. The awning was tattered, and the doorman looked like a wino.
Here, huh? Jonah said.
Man, you guys like to rough it.
Me? I'm staying at the Ritz.
If you change your mind, you know where to find me.
Amy dragged Nellie and Dan out of the car. The driver tossed out their bags, and the wizard's limo glided away.
What a creep,
Nellie said.
He isn't like that on TV.
Dan looked up at the Maison des Gardons.
Don't tell me we're actually staying here. I had to get him to stop the car, Amy said. Nellie, get us rooms for the night.
Here?
She protested.
But it says gardens in the title. How bad can it be?
That doesn't say... Just do it, please.
Amy felt weird acting so bossy, but she didn't have time to argue.
We'll meet you back here in, I don't know, 2 hours.
Why?
Dan said.
Where are we going?
I just saw an old friend, Amy said.
Come on.
She dragged him across the street, hoping they weren't too late. With relief, she spotted her target.
There,
she pointed.
In the red.
Half a block down, a woman in a red shawl was walking briskly. Something was tucked under her arm. Something thin, square, red, and white. Dan's eyes widened.
Isn't that... Irina Spassky,
Amy said,
and she's got our poor Richard's almanac. Follow that Russian.
Chapter 12. Dan was tempted to stop about 20 times as they trailed Irina Spassky down the Rue de Rivoli. He wondered if that meant the Street of Ravioli, but he decided Amy would laugh at him if he asked. A few times he wanted to check stuff out, like the cool glass pyramid at the Louvre and the street performers who were juggling fire outside the Tuileries garden. There was also a vendor selling creme glacée, and Dan was pretty sure that meant ice cream. Mostly, though, he wanted to stop because his feet hurt.
"Is she ever going to take a break?" he complained.
Amy didn't seem to be getting tired at all.
"Does it seem odd to you that we happened to find Irina Spassky out of 10 million people in Paris? Maybe the other 9.99 million aren't wearing bright red scarves. She was walking down a major street, like she wanted to be spotted." "You think it's a trap?" Dan asked. "How could she know we'd find her? And she hasn't looked back once. She doesn't know we're here."
But as he said that, Dan remembered television shows he'd seen about spies, how they could tail somebody without ever being seen, or appear accidentally in a victim's line of sight and lure them into a trap. Could Irina have been waiting for them at the airport? Could she have seen them get in the limo with Jonah and somehow gotten ahead of them?
"Look," Amy said, "she's turning."
Irina crossed the avenue and disappeared down a flight of steps.
"The metro," Amy said. "She's taking the subway."
They lost time figuring out how to use euro coins in the machines to get tickets, but when they got down the steps, Irina was still there, standing on one of the platforms with the tattered almanac tucked under her arm. The train was just arriving. Dan was sure Irina was going to try one of those last-minute switches, so they waited until the train's doors were closing, but Irina stayed on board. Amy and Dan jumped on too, and the train pulled away from the station. They changed trains twice in a really short time. Even with Irina in a bright red shawl, it was hard to keep up with her.
"I don't get it," Amy said. "Now she's moving faster, like she's trying to lose us."
Dan was daydreaming about creme glacée. The lasagna he'd had on the plane was long gone, and his stomach felt like it was trying to chew through his shirt. Finally, after the third train, Irina exited onto the platform. Amy gripped Dan's arm and pointed to a sign on the station wall.
"Passy," she said.
"So?
This is the neighborhood where Benjamin Franklin lived."
"Well, come on,"
Dan said.
"Red Riding Hood's getting away."
Passy didn't seem as crowded as Tuileries. The streets were lined with four-story buildings. There were flower shops everywhere, like a Mother's Day explosion. Tulips, carnations, roses, everything that could possibly make Dan sneeze. In the distance, the Eiffel Tower rose against the gray clouds, but Dan was more interested in the smell of food. The whole city seemed to be made up of outdoor cafes. He could smell chocolate, fresh baked bread, melting cheese, but Dan didn't have time to get any of it. Irina walked like her dress was on fire. They had to jog to keep up. Amy tripped over a bucket of flowers, and a Parisian cursed at her.
"Sorry," Amy called back.
They turned onto a tree-lined street with ancient-looking mansions. Halfway up the block, a purple van was parked crookedly. It was painted with pictures of balloons and clown faces, and the sign read, "Creme Glacée." Dan's spirits lifted. Maybe he could just grab a quick triple scoop of cherry vanilla to go. But as they got closer, he saw that the van was shut. The windshield was covered from the inside with a silver screen. It was a conspiracy, Dan decided. The entire city of Paris was trying to starve him. At the end of the block, Irina crossed the street and ducked inside a wrought iron gate. She walked up to a large marble building that looked like an embassy or something. Dan hid behind a gatepost and watched as Irina punched a security code and went inside.
"Look at the gate," Amy said.
In the center was a gold-lettered sign that read, "Institut de Diplomatie Internationale." Institute for International Diplomacy.
"The Lucian Crest," Dan said. "But what's an institution for, whatever that means?"
"I guess it's like a school for ambassadors," Amy said. "But don't you get it? That's just a cover. You remember what Jonah said? Paris is a Lucian stronghold."
Dan's eyes lit up.
This must be their secret base.
Amy nodded.
The question is, what do we do?
We go in,
Dan said.
Right, without the security code?
5910. I watched her punch it in.
Amy stared at him.
How did you... Never mind. Let's go. But be careful. They probably have cameras and guard dogs and stuff.
They squeezed inside the gate and ran up the front steps. Dan punched in the code. The door opened easily. No alarms went off. No guard dogs barked.
Weird,
he muttered. But it was too late for second guessing. They slipped inside the Lucian base. The entry hall was bigger than their whole apartment. The floor was polished marble and a chandelier hung from the ceiling. A set of black doors stood in front of them. On the left, a spiral staircase led up to a balcony.
Look!
Dan pointed above the doors. A surveillance camera was sweeping the room. It was angled away from them, but it wouldn't be for long. Then he heard voices from behind the double doors, someone coming in their direction.
Quick!
He ran for the stairs. Amy looked like she wanted to argue, but there was no time. She followed him up. Dan's heart pounded. He always thought it would be cool to play burglar and sneak into someone's house, but now that he was doing it for real, his hands were sweating. He wondered if the French still threw burglars into rat-infested dungeons. He'd seen something like that once in a musical Grace took them to. They sneaked along a second-floor hallway.
I don't get it,
Dan whispered.
Irina must be a Lucian. Benjamin Franklin was a Lucian. Does that mean that Franklin was one of the bad guys?
Maybe it's not that simple, Amy said.
Look.
Painted portraits hung along the walls. Napoleon Bonaparte, Isaac Newton, Winston Churchill, a few others Dan didn't recognize.
More famous Lucians, Amy guessed. Not necessarily good or bad, but definitely a lot of powerful people.
And we just invaded their house, Dan said.
They passed a row of heavy oak doors, all of them closed. One was labeled Logistique, another read Cartographie. The last door on the right read Arsenal.
Sweet!
Dan, no,
Amy whispered, but she was too late to intercept him. Dan opened the arsenal door and slipped inside. A little late, he considered that it might not be a good idea to enter a room full of weapons if there was already someone in there. Fortunately, there wasn't. The arsenal was about 30 feet square and full of amazingly cool stuff. Crates of cannonballs, racks of knives, swords, canes, shields, and umbrellas. Dan wasn't sure about the umbrellas, but he figured they did something besides just stop the rain.
We shouldn't be here,
Amy hissed.
Gee, you think?
Dan picked up a shoebox-sized wooden crate full of glass tubes with copper wires twined around the tops.
Hey, it's one of those Franklin batteries, like in the museum.
Amy's eyebrows furrowed.
What's it doing in an arsenal?
Don't know, but I'm collecting it.
Despite Amy's protests, Dan stuffed the battery in his backpack. It fit because the pack was pretty much empty. The only other thing he had in there was the picture of his parents, wrapped in its plastic sleeve, which he decided to keep with him for good luck. A styrofoam egg carton caught his eye. He opened it and found a single silver orb with little blinking red lights.
This is cool, too.
He dropped it into his backpack.
Dan, no! What? They've got plenty of other stuff, and we need all the help we can get. It could be dangerous. I hope so.
He was admiring the shurikens and thinking he might take some of those, too, when a door slammed somewhere down the hall.
Better know what she's doing, a man said in English. If she's wrong,
a woman responded in French. Both voices faded down the corridor.
Come on, Amy insisted. Now.
They poked their heads out to make sure the hall was clear, then sneaked out of the arsenal and deeper into the building. At the end of the hallway was another balcony, this one looking down on a big circular room. What Dan saw below reminded him of a military command center. There were computers along the walls, and in the middle of the room was a conference table that seemed to be one huge flat-screen TV. Irina Spassky was alone, leaning over the tabletop. Stacks of papers and folders sat next to her. She was punching commands on the tabletop, making images zoom or shrink. She was looking at a satellite map of the city. Dan didn't dare speak, but he locked eyes with Amy.
I want one of those, he told her.
Amy's expression said,
shut up.
They crouched behind the balcony rail and watched as Arena commanded the map to zoom in on different locations. She checked the poor Richard's almanac book, then got out a pad of paper and jotted something down. She snatched up the book and the pad and hurried out of the room, back toward the main entrance.
Amy, come on!
Dan straddled the railing.
You'll break your legs. Hang from the edge and just drop. I've done it off the roof at school a million times. It's easy.
He did, and it was. A second later, they were both at the conference table, staring at the image still flickering on the screen. A white targeting icon hovering over one particular spot in Paris. The address glowed in red letters. 23 Rue Desjardins. Dan pointed to a ribbon of blue surrounding the dot.
That's water, which means that little blob she was targeting must be an island.
The Île Saint-Louis, Amy said. It's on the Seine River, right in the middle of Paris. Can you memorize that address?
Already done.
Then Dan noticed something else, a photograph sitting on top of Irina Spassky's files. He picked it up and felt sick to his stomach.
It's him.
Dan showed Amy the photo, an older man with gray hair and a black suit crossing the street. The photo was fuzzy, but it must have been taken in Paris. Dan could tell from the yellow stone buildings and the French signs.
The man in black is here.
Amy paled.
But why?
Chapter 13. Meanwhile, inside the ice cream van, the Holtz were strangling each other. Madison was on Hamilton's back, hitting him over the head with a box of fudgesicles. Their mother, Mary Todd, was trying to pull them apart. Reagan and Arnold, the pit bull, were playing tug of war with a package of Eskimo pies. Eisenhower, the weary leader of the family, bellowed, "Stop it! Company, fall in!" Hamilton and Madison separated and snapped to attention, dropping the fudgesicles. Mary Todd brushed herself off, glared at her children, then fell into line. Reagan held the Eskimo pies in present arms stance. Arnold rolled over and played dead.
Right, Eisenhower growled. I will not have this family killing each other over frozen dairy products.
Reagan said,
But Dad...
Silence! I said you'd get ice cream after we finish the mission, and we are not finished until I get a report.
Madison saluted.
Dad, permission to report.
Go ahead.
The surveillance microphone worked.
Excellent. Did the brats take the book?
Madison shifted uncomfortably.
I don't know, sir, but they're going to 23 Rue Desjardins, Île Saint-Louis.
If you got the number right this time, Hamilton griped.
Madison's face turned bright red.
That wasn't my fault. We drove the rental car into the Seine. Oh, and you have all the great ideas, Hammy, like that stupid explosion that hit the wrong team in the museum, or burning down Grace's mansion. Stop yelling, Mary Todd yelled. Children, we can't keep arguing with each other. It hurts team morale.
Your mother is right, Eisenhower said. The fire at the mansion and the museum bomb were both bad ideas. We should have pulverized the Cahill brats in person.
Arnold barked excitedly and tried to bite Eisenhower's nose. Reagan knit her eyebrows. She shifted uncomfortably from foot to foot.
But, Dad...
Problem, Reagan?
Well, the explosion. I mean, it could have killed them, right?
Madison rolled her eyes.
Oh, here we go again. You're going soft, Reagan.
Reagan's face turned bright red.
Am not. R2.
Quiet, Eisenhower bellowed. Now look, everybody. We're going to have to use some drastic measures to win this contest. I can't have anybody going soft. Understood?
He glared at Reagan, who stared glumly at the floor.
Yes, sir.
We know Dan and Amy were Grace's favorites, Eisenhower continued. Old McIntyre is probably giving them inside information. Now they've beat us inside the Lucian stronghold while we were trying to do surveillance, which was also a bad idea. Are we going to tolerate any more bad ideas?
No, sir,
the kid shouted.
They think we're not clever, Eisenhower said. They think all we can do is flex our muscles. Well, they're about to find out we can do more than that.
Eisenhower flexed his muscles.
Teamwork,
Mary Todd cried.
Right, children?
Yes, sir. Teamwork.
Arf,
Arnold said.
Now, Eisenhower said, we have to get that book. We've got to assume those brats have it, or they know what's in it. We need to get to the Île Saint-Louis without driving the ice cream van into the river. Who's with me?
The kids and Mary Todd cheered. Then they remembered the ice cream, and the kids went back to strangling each other. Eisenhower grunted. He decided he'd let them wrestle for a while. Maybe it would build character. All his life, people had laughed behind Eisenhower's back. They'd laughed when he'd flunked out of West Point. They'd laughed when he failed the entrance exam for the FBI. They'd even laughed the time he was working as a security guard, when he'd chased a shoplifter and accidentally tasered himself in the rear end. A simple mistake. Anyone could have made it. Once he won this contest, he would become the most powerful Cahill of all time. No one would ever laugh at him again. He pounded his fist into the van's cash register. Those Cahill kids were starting to get on his nerves. They were too much like their parents, Arthur and Hope. Eisenhower had known them all too well. He had an old score to settle with the Cahills. Soon, Amy and Dan Cahill would pay. Chapter 14. Amy was all in favor of rushing to the Île Saint-Louis, but her stomach had other ideas. They passed a boulangerie, which must have meant bakery, judging by the yummy smells, and Dan and she exchanged looks.
Just one stop, they said together.
A few minutes later, they were sitting on the quay of the river, sharing the best meal they'd ever had. It was only a loaf of bread, but Amy had never tasted anything so good.
See that?
Amy pointed to the top of a nearby church, where a black iron spike rose from the bell tower.
Lightning rod.
Mmm,
Dan said with his mouth full.
The French were the first ones to test Franklin's theories about lightning rods. A lot of the old buildings still have original Franklin models.
Mmm,
Dan said enthusiastically, but Amy wasn't sure whether he liked the story or the bread. The sun was going down behind a bulkhead of black clouds. Thunder rumbled in the distance, but the Parisians didn't seem too concerned. Joggers and skaters crowded the riverside. A sightseeing boat loaded with tourists hummed along on the Seine. Amy tried to use the Starling's cell phone to call Nelly, but the phone was dead. Apparently, it wasn't set up to get a signal in France. Her nerves were still buzzing from their raid on the Lucian stronghold. Despite all the security, it still seemed like they'd gotten in and out pretty easily, and she wasn't sure why. She also didn't like the stuff Dan had taken, the Franklin battery and that weird metal sphere. She knew better than to argue with him about it, though. Once he got his hands on something, he hardly ever let it go.
She wondered how Irina Spassky had gotten the book from Uncle Alistair, and why she would be interested in the Île Saint-Louis. It felt like a trap, but it was Amy's only lead, or at least the only lead she wanted to think about.
Her mother's note in the Poor Richard's Almanac, "The Maze of Bones," still gave her chills. She tried to imagine what her mother or Grace would do in her place. They would be braver. They'd see what to do more clearly. Her mother had once searched for these same clues. Amy was sure of that now. Grace had intended Amy to take up the challenge, but what if Amy wasn't up to it? So far, she felt like she'd done a terrible job. Every time she'd needed to speak up, she failed. The other teams probably thought she was a mumbling loser. If it wasn't for Dan, she would have been lost. Just thinking about it made a lump form in her throat. They finished the bread. Amy knew they needed to get moving. She stared at the darkening sky and tried to remember details from her Paris guidebooks.
There aren't any metro lines to the Île Saint-Louis, she said. We'll have to walk.
Let's do it.
Dan hopped to his feet. Amy couldn't believe how quickly his spirits had rebounded. A few minutes ago, he'd been complaining about his feet and his heavy backpack. Now, a hunk of bread later, he was as good as new. Amy wished she was like that. She felt like lying down and sleeping for a century, but she wasn't going to tell that to Dan. It was full dark by the time they got to the Pont Louis-Philippe. The old stone bridge was lined with street lamps that glowed against the water. On the opposite side rose a cluster of trees and mansions, the Île Saint-Louis. To the north was a larger island with a huge cathedral lit up yellow in the night.
That's the Île de la Cité over there, Amy said as they walked across, mostly to keep herself calm. And that's Notre Dame Cathedral.
Cool,
Dan said.
You think we can see the hunchback?
Maybe later.
Amy decided not to tell him that the hunchback of Notre Dame was just a character in a book.
Anyway, the smaller island we're going to, the Île Saint-Louis, the tour books hardly said anything about it. Mostly old houses and shops and stuff. I don't know why Irina would be looking there. No Ben Franklin history?
Amy shook her head.
It used to be called the Island of the Cows, because that's all that lived there. Then they turned it into a neighborhood.
Cows, Dan said. Exciting.
After the other parts of Paris they'd seen, the Île Saint-Louis felt like a ghost town. The narrow streets were lined with elegant old apartments, 5 stories tall with black gabled roofs. Most of the windows were dark. A lot of the shops were closed. Street lamps cast weird shadows through the branches of the trees, making monster shapes on the walls. Amy was too old to believe in monsters, but the shadows still made her uneasy. An elderly couple crossed the street in front of them. Amy wondered if it was her imagination, or if the couple really glanced at her suspiciously before they disappeared into an alleyway. On the next block, a guy in a beret was walking a Labrador Retriever. He smiled as he passed Amy and Dan, but his expression reminded Amy of Ian Cabra, like he knew a secret.
You're just getting paranoid, she told herself. Or was it possible there were other people seeking the clues, people that weren't even part of the 7 teams?
She glanced at Dan, but decided not to say anything about this. Not yet. The contest was already overwhelming enough. After another 100 yards, they found the Rue Desjardins. It was narrower than the streets around it, with crumbling stone buildings that might have stood there for centuries. Amy counted the street numbers. She stopped abruptly.
Dan, 23 Rue Desjardins? Are you sure?
Yeah, why?
Amy pointed. There was no building at 23 Rue Desjardins. Instead, ringed with a rusty iron fence, was a tiny cemetery. At the back stood a marble mausoleum. In front, a dozen weathered headstones slanted every direction, like crooked teeth. The cemetery was sandwiched by tall buildings on either side. The one on the right said, Musée. The one on the left must have been some kind of shop once, but the windows were painted black and the door boarded up. The only light came from the dim orange glow of the city sky, which made the place seem even creepier.
I don't like this, Amy said. There can't be any connection to Franklin here.
How do you know? Dan asked. We haven't even searched. And those tombstones look cool.
No, Dan, you cannot do charcoal rubbings.
Aw.
He walked through the cemetery gates, and Amy had no choice but to follow. The tombstones told them nothing. Once upon a time, they might have had inscriptions, but they'd been worn smooth over the centuries. Amy's pulse was racing. Something wasn't right. She racked her brain, trying to figure out why this place might be important to Ben Franklin, but she couldn't come up with anything. Cautiously, she approached the mausoleum. She'd always hated above-ground burial places. They made her think of dollhouses for dead people. The iron doors stood open. Amy was hesitant to get close. From 10 feet away, she couldn't see anything special inside, just old nameplates lining the walls, but a slab of marble lay on the ground in front of the doorway. With a start, Amy realized the inscription was a lot newer than the rest of the cemetery. It looked freshly carved.
Se trouve ici Amy et Dan Cahill. Ils ont collé leur nez dans les affaires des autres.
Whoa,
Dan said.
Why are our names?
Some kind of message.
Amy desperately wished she could read French. If she ever got back to the hotel, she promised herself she would make Nellie give her lessons.
Inside, right?
Dan said.
No, it's a trap.
But he stepped forward, and the ground collapsed. The marble slab dropped into nothingness, taking Dan with it.
Dan!
She ran to the edge of the hole, but the ground hadn't finished crumbling. Stone and dirt gave way like cloth under her feet, and Amy tumbled into darkness. For a second, she was too dazed to think. She coughed, her lungs filling with dust. She was sitting on something soft and warm.
Dan!
In a panic, she scrambled off him and shook his arms, but it was too dark to see.
Dan, please be alive!
Ugh,
he grunted.
Are you okay?
My sister just sat on me with her bony butt. Of course I'm not okay.
Amy breathed a sigh of relief. If he was being annoying, he must be fine. She got up unsteadily, dirt and stones shifting beneath her feet. Looking up, she could see the mouth of the ragged pit they'd fallen into. They were in some kind of a sinkhole.
The ground was hollowed out, she muttered. The earth here is limestone,
Lots of caves and tunnels under Paris. I guess we fell into one accidentally.
Accidentally? Dan said. Irina lured us here on purpose.
Amy knew he was probably right, but she didn't want to think about it, or what might happen next. They had to get out. She swept her arms around the edges of their pit, but it was just that, a pit. No side tunnels, no exits except for straight up, and they'd fallen over 10 feet. It was a miracle they hadn't broken any bones. Suddenly, a light blinded her from above.
Well, well, said a man's voice.
Ruff,
a dog yapped. When Amy's eyes adjusted, she saw 5 figures in purple warm-up suits smiling down at them, and one very excited pit bull.
The Holtz, Dan said. It figures. You helped Irina set us up.
Oh, get over it, runt, Madison called down. We didn't set up anybody.
Yeah, Reagan said. You fell in all by yourselves.
She and Madison gave each other high fives and started laughing. Amy's hands started to tremble. This was just like her nightmares, stuck in a pit, a crowd of people laughing at her. But this was real.
So, Eisenhower Holt called down, is this what you brats were looking for? Is this the maze of bones?
Her heart fluttered.
What do you mean?
Oh, come on, Missy. We know all about the maze of bones. We read the almanac.
You'd have the book, but Irina...
stole it from us, Eisenhower growled. After we stole it from the Korean dude. So we staked out her headquarters, but you got inside before we could launch an assault. Now you've got the book, and you came here, which means you know something.
But we don't have the book, Amy said. We didn't even get a chance to...
Oh, come on, Hamilton said. His greased blonde hair gleamed in the night. It was right there on page 52. BF, maze of bones, coordinates in the box. It was your mom's handwriting. Dad recognized it.
Amy's whole body was trembling. She hated it, but she couldn't stop. The Holtz had read farther in the book than she had. They'd found another message from her mother. Maze of bones, coordinates in the box. She understood the maze of bones part, at least she feared that she did. But coordinates in a box?
I don't know what it means, she said. We don't have the book, but if you let us out of here, maybe I could...
Yeah, right, Madison sneered. Like we'd help you.
They started laughing again, the entire Holt clan making fun of her.
Please stop, she whispered. Don't...
Aw, she's gonna cry,
Hamilton grinned.
Man, you two are pathetic. I can't believe you got past the fire and the bomb.
What?
Dan yelled.
You burned Grace's mansion? You set off that bomb in the museum?
To slow you down, Eisenhower admitted. We should have beaten you up in person. Sorry about that.
Dan threw a rock, but it sailed harmlessly between Reagan's legs.
You morons! Get us out of here!
Reagan frowned, but Madison and Hamilton started yelling back at Dan. Arnold barked. Amy knew this was getting them nowhere. They had to convince the Holtz to let them out, but she couldn't make her voice work. She wanted to curl into a ball and hide. Then the ground shook. There was a rumbling sound like a large engine. The Holtz turned toward the street and looked astonished by whatever they saw.
You little tricksters!
Eisenhower glared down at them.
This was an ambush, wasn't it?
What are you talking about?
Dan asked.
A truck is blocking the gates, Mary Todd said. A cement truck.
Dad, look,
Reagan said nervously.
They've got shovels.
Amy's danger sense started tingling. Dan turned toward her, and she could tell he was thinking the same thing.
They're going to fill the hole, Dan said. Aren't they?
She nodded weakly.
Mr. Holt!
Dan started jumping like Arnold the dog, but he couldn't reach the top of the pit.
Come on, you've got to get us out. We'll help you.
Mr. Holt snorted.
You let us into this. Besides, you runts can't fight.
Dad, Reagan said, maybe we should.
Shut up, sis, Hamilton growled. We can handle this.
Reagan, Dan yelled. Come on, tell them to let us out.
Reagan just knit her eyebrows and stared at the ground. Dan looked at Amy desperately.
You gotta do something. Tell them you can figure out the book.
But the words wouldn't come. Amy felt like she was already being covered in cement. Her brother needed her. She had to say something. But she just stood there, frozen and helpless, and hating herself for being so scared.
Hey! Dan yelled up. Amy knows what the clue means. She'll tell you if you let us out.
Mr. Holt scowled. Amy knew he wouldn't go for it. They'd be stuck down here forever, cemented in. Then Mr. Holt stripped off his warm-up jacket and lowered it into the pit.
Grab the sleeve.
Within seconds, Amy and Dan were out of the pit. Sure enough, a cement truck had blocked the gates of the cemetery. Six thugs in coveralls and hard hats were lined up at the fence, hefting shovels like they were ready to fight.
All right, team, Mr. Holt said with relish. Let's show 'em how it's done. Holt style!
The whole family rushed forward. Mr. Holt grabbed the first thug's shovel and swung it, with the guy still attached, into the side of the cement truck.
Clang!
The girls, Madison and Reagan, plowed into one thug so hard he flew across the street and crashed through the window of a flower shop. Arnold bit the third thug in the leg and held on with jaws of iron. Mary Todd and Hamilton tackled a fourth thug against the chute on the back of the truck. His head hit a lever and cement started spilling all over the street. Unfortunately, two thugs remained, and they ran straight for Amy and Dan. Fear closed around Amy's throat. She recognized their faces. They were the security guards from the Lucian stronghold. Before she could even think of a plan, Dan unzipped his backpack and took out his blinking silver sphere.
Dan, no, Amy said. You can't.
But he did. As much as he loved baseball, Dan was the world's worst pitcher. The sphere sailed right past the two guys who were charging them and exploded under Mr. Holt's feet with a blinding yellow flash. The noise was like the world's largest snare drum being smashed with a sledgehammer. Amy went cross-eyed. When she regained her senses, she saw the entire Holt family and the guys they'd been battling flat on the ground, knocked unconscious, except for the two thugs Dan meant to hit. They were only dazed, stumbling around and shaking their heads. Amy turned to Dan in horror.
What did you do?
Dan looked surprised.
Concussive grenade, I think, like the one in the museum. I knocked them out.
The two thugs who were still on their feet blinked a few times, then refocused on Dan and Amy. They didn't look happy.
Run!
Dan pulled Amy behind the mausoleum, but there was nowhere to go. Just another iron fence, and a few yards behind that, the back of a building. Brick walls, 30 feet high. Desperately, they climbed the fence anyway. Amy's shirt got stuck on the top, but Dan pulled her free. Together they pressed against the back wall. There was no alley, no exit. They were trapped. If only they had a weapon. And then Amy realized her brain wasn't paralyzed by fear anymore. The explosion had snapped her back to her senses. She knew what they needed.
Dan, the Franklin battery.
What good will that do?
She ripped open his backpack and took out the battery. The two thugs advanced warily, probably wondering whether Dan had any more grenades. Amy uncoiled the battery's copper wires and made sure the ends were stripped.
I hope it has a charge.
What are you doing?
Dan asked.
Franklin used to do this for fun, she said, to startle his friends. Maybe if it's got enough juice.
The men were at the fence. One of them snarled something in French. It sounded like an order to surrender. Amy shook her head. The men began to climb, and Amy leaped forward. She touched the wires against the fence, and the men yelped in surprise. Blue sparks flew off the metal bars. Smoke curled from the men's hands, and they fell backwards, stunned. Amy threw down the battery.
Come on,
she yelled. In a heartbeat, they were over the fence. They raced out of the graveyard, past the unconscious Holts, the thugs, and the overturned cement truck. Amy felt a twinge of guilt leaving the Holts behind unconscious, but they had no choice. They didn't stop running until they were halfway across the Pont Louis-Philippe. Amy doubled over, gasping for breath. At last, they were safe. They'd survived the trap. But when she looked back, she saw something that scared her worse than the graveyard. Standing in the shadows at the foot of the bridge, 100 yards back the way they'd come, was a tall, gray-haired man in a black overcoat. And Amy was sure he was watching them. Chapter 15. Dan thought Nellie was going to kill them. He'd never seen her face that shade of red before.
You did what?
She paced their tiny hotel room.
2 hours, you said.
2 hours, and I was standing outside the hotel for, like, ever, and you didn't come. You didn't call. I thought you were dead.
She shook her iPod for emphasis, and the loose earbuds danced around.
Our phone didn't work, Amy said sheepishly.
We got sidetracked, Dan added. There was this concussive grenade, and a cement truck, and a battery, and a loaf of bread.
Dan was pretty sure that covered all the important details, but Nellie looked like she didn't understand.
Start from the beginning, she said, and no lies.
Maybe it was just because he was too tired to lie, but Dan told her the whole story, even about the 39 clues, with Amy filling in the stuff he forgot.
So you almost died, Nellie said in a small voice. Those jerks were going to pour cement on you.
Maybe a little cement, Dan said.
What did the inscription say?
Nellie asked. Dan didn't know any French, but he'd automatically memorized the words on the marble slab. He repeated them to Nellie.
Here lie Amy and Dan Cahill, she translated, who stuck their noses into the wrong people's business.
It was Irina Spassky's fault, Dan said. She tricked us into going there. The whole thing was a setup.
And we can't even pay you, Amy added miserably. We don't have enough money for the flight home. I'm really sorry, Nellie.
Nellie stood very still. Her glitter eyeshadow was red today, which made her eyes look even angrier. Her arms were crossed over her t-shirt, which showed a picture of a screaming punk rocker. All in all, she looked pretty scary. Then she grabbed Amy and Dan and hugged them fiercely. She knelt down so she was looking them in the eyes.
I've got some credit left on my MasterCard. We'll be fine.
Dan was confused.
But you're not going to kill us?
I'm going to help you, stupid.
Nellie shook his shoulders gently.
Nobody messes with my baby cities.
Oh, Paris,
Dan corrected.
Whatever. Now get some sleep. Tomorrow we're going to slap some people senseless.
Maison des Gardons did not mean the House of Gardens. Apparently, Gardon meant roaches. Dan found this out because Nellie told him and because he heard scuttling sounds along the floor all night long. He wished Saladin were there. The cat would have had a great time playing jungle stalker. In the morning, everybody looked bleary-eyed, but they showered and changed clothes. Nellie came back from the corner cafe with coffee for herself, hot chocolate for Dan and Amy, and pain au chocolat for all of them. Dan figured any country that ate chocolate for breakfast couldn't be all bad.
So,
Dan said,
can I get some more grenades today?
No, Amy said. Dan, you're lucky it was only concussive. You could have wiped out the whole Holt family.
And that would have been bad because...
Okay, knock it off, Nellie said. The important thing is you guys are safe.
Amy picked at her croissant. She looked pale this morning. Her hair was a tangled mess.
Dan, I'm sorry about last night. I panicked. I almost got us killed.
Dan had pretty much forgotten that part. He'd been annoyed with her at the time, but it was hard to stay mad when Amy looked so miserable and apologized. Plus, she'd done that cool thing with the battery, which had kind of made up for her freaking out.
Don't worry about it, he said.
But if it happens again...
Hey, if we let Irina lure us into a trap again, we're stupider than the Holts.
Amy didn't look very comforted.
What I don't understand is the man in black. Why was he there last night? And if the Holts started the fire at the mansion and set up the museum explosion...
Then what was the man in black doing in both places?
Dan finished.
And why did Irina have a photo of him?
He waited for Amy to come up with one of her, oh, I did a book report on that last year, answers, but she just kept frowning at her breakfast.
Maybe you guys should concentrate on where we go next, Nellie advised.
Amy took a deep breath.
I think I know where to go. Dan, can I use your laptop?
He stared at her because Amy didn't like computers. But finally he brought it over, and Amy started searching the internet. In no time, she grimaced and turned the screen for them to see. The picture showed a pile of bones in a dark stone room.
I've suspected for a while, Amy said, but I was hoping I was wrong because it's risky. The maze of bones. That's what Mom's note said in Poor Richard's Almanac. We have to explore the catacombs.
Is that where they keep the cats?
Dan asked. It seemed like a perfectly reasonable question to him. but Amy gave him a, "You're such a dummy," look.
"The catacombs are an underground maze," she said. "I told you Paris is riddled with caves and tunnels, right? All the limestone they used to build the city, ever since the Roman days, they dug from underground, and it left a whole network of empty spaces. Some are just pits, like the one we fell in last night."
"And some are networks of tunnels," Nellie said. "Yeah, I remember hearing about this. And they're filled with bones, right?"
"I want a room decorated with bones," Dan said. "Where'd they come from?"
"Cemeteries," Amy said. "Back in the 1700s, the cemeteries were getting overcrowded, so they decided to dig up tons of old bodies, all their bones, and move them into the catacombs. The thing is, look at the dates. See when they started moving bones into the catacombs?"
Dan squinted at the screen. He didn't see what she was talking about.
"Is it my birthday?"
"No, doofus, look. 1785. They didn't officially declare it open until the next year, but they started planning the project and moving the bones in 1785, which was also the last year Benjamin Franklin was in Paris."
"Whoa, you mean..."
"He hid something down there."
It got so quiet, Dan could hear roaches scuttling in the closet.
"So," Nellie said, "we have to go underground into a maze filled with bones and find whatever it is."
Amy nodded.
"Except the catacombs are huge. We don't know where to look. The only thing I can think, there's one public entrance. It says here it's across from the Denfert Rochereau metro station in the 14th arrondissement."
"But if that's the only public entrance," Dan said,
"then the other teams might head there too. Everybody's been stealing that almanac from each other. They'll figure out the maze of bones thing eventually, if they haven't already."
"Good enough for me."
Nellie brushed the chocolate and breadcrumbs off her shirt.
"Let's go meet your family."
Dan's backpack was a lot lighter today, but before they left, he made sure the photo of his parents was still safe in the side pocket. His mom and dad were right where he'd left them, in their plastic photo album sheet, smiling from the top of their mountain like they hadn't minded sharing space with a Franklin battery and a grenade at all. He wondered if they'd be proud of him for getting out of that pit last night, or if they'd be all protective like Amy.
"You almost got yourself killed, blah, blah, blah."
He decided they would have been cooler than that. They'd probably had tons of dangerous adventures. Maybe their house had an arsenal too, before it burned down.
"Dan!"
Amy called.
"Get out of the bathroom and let's go!"
"Coming!"
he shouted. He looked at his parents one more time.
"Thanks for the note about the maze of bones, Mom. I won't let you down."
He slipped the photo back into his pack and went to join Amy and Nellie. They weren't out of the Denfert Rochereau metro station 2 minutes before they spotted Uncle Alistair. He was kind of hard to miss in his cherry red suit and canary yellow ascot, his diamond-tipped cane swinging in one hand. The old man sauntered toward them, smiling with his arms out. As he got closer, Dan noticed he had a black eye.
"My dear children!"
Nellie whopped him upside the head with her backpack.
"Ow!"
Uncle Alistair curled over, cupping his hand over his good eye.
"Nellie!"
Amy said.
"Sorry," Nellie muttered. "I thought he was one of the bad guys."
"He is,"
Dan agreed.
"No, no!"
Alistair tried to smile, but all he could do was wince and blink. Dan figured his other eye was going to be black now thanks to that pop. Nellie's backpack was not light.
"Children, please, you must believe me. I am not your enemy."
"You stole the book from us," Dan said, "and left us for dead."
"Children, I admit it. I thought you were lost in the fire. I barely made it out myself. Fortunately, I found a latch that opened the door. I called for you, but you must have discovered another way out. I had the almanac, yes. I couldn't leave it behind. I admit I panicked when I got outside. I feared our enemies were still about, or that I would be blamed for the terrible fire. So I fled. Forgive me."
Amy's scowl softened, but Dan didn't believe this guy at all.
"He's lying,"
Dan said.
"Trust no one, remember?" "Should I hit him again?"
Nellie asked. Uncle Alistair flinched.
"Please, listen. The catacombs are right there."
He pointed across the street to a simple building with a black facade.
White letters above the door read, Entrée des Catacombes. The street around it looked like a normal neighborhood. Townhouses, apartments, pedestrians on their way to work. It was hard to believe a maze of dead people lay right underneath.
I must speak with you before you go in,
Alistair insisted.
All I ask is 10 minutes. You are in grave danger.
Grave danger, Dan grumbled. That's supposed to be a joke.
Dan, Amy put her hand on his arm. Maybe we should listen to him. 10 minutes. What do we have to lose?
Dan could think of a lot of things, but Alistair smiled.
Thank you, my dear. There is a cafe just here. Shall we?
Alistair was buying, so Dan ordered an early lunch, a turkey and cheese sandwich with chips and a large Coke, which for some weird reason was delivered in a glass with no ice. Nellie spoke with the waiter in French for a long time and ordered some exotic gourmet thing. The waiter looked impressed with her choice, but when it came, Dan couldn't tell what it was. It looked like gobs of silly putty and garlic butter. In a sad voice, Alistair explained how the Holts had ambushed him outside De Gaulle Airport and taken the poor Richard's almanac.
The barbarians hit me in the face and cracked one of my ribs. I really am getting too old for this sort of thing.
He touched his bruised eyes.
But why is everyone trying to kill each other over that book? Amy asked. Aren't there other ways to find the clue, like the invisible message we found in Philadelphia?
Amy,
Dan said.
Keep secrets much?
It's all right, my boy, Alistair said. You're correct, of course, Amy. There are many possible paths toward the next clue. For instance, I found a message encoded in a famous portrait by... Well, here, see for yourself.
Uncle Alistair reached into his coat and pulled out a paper. He unfolded a color print of a painting. It showed Benjamin Franklin as an old man in a red, flowing robe, sitting in a thunderstorm, which seemed kind of dumb. A bunch of baby angels hovered around him, two at his feet working on batteries, and three more right behind him, holding up a kite with a key on the string. Lightning zapped from the key into Ben's upraised hand. Ben didn't look upset by this. His long gray hair was wild and frizzed out, so maybe he was used to getting shocked.
No way did it happen like that, Dan said, with the angels and all.
No, Dan, Alistair agreed. It's symbolic. The painter, Benjamin West, meant to show Franklin as a hero for drawing lightning out of the sky. But there is more symbolism than I realized. Signs hidden so deep, only a Cahill could discover them. Look at Franklin's knee.
Dan didn't see anything except a knee, but Amy gasped.
That shape in the fabric.
Dan squinted, and he saw what she meant. Part of Franklin's knee was painted in a lighter shade of red, but it wasn't just a random blotch. It was a silhouette he'd seen many times before.
Whoa, he said. The Lucian crest.
Nellie squinted.
That? That looks like one of those ladies on a trucker's mud flaps.
No, it's two snakes around a sword, Amy said. Trust me, if you'd seen the Lucian crest, you'd recognize it.
There's more, Alistair said. Look at the paper Franklin is holding. Turn it upside down. There, brushed over with white paint, almost impossible to read.
Dan would never have noticed if Alistair hadn't said something, but when he looked closely, he could see the faint shadow of words on the document in Franklin's hand.
Paris, he read. 1785. Exactly, my dear boy. A painting of Franklin with a key, the Cahill family crest, and the words Paris, 1785. A significant hint.
I never would have found this,
Amy said in amazement. Alistair shrugged.
As you said, my dear, there are many possible hints, all leading us along the path to the second clue. Unfortunately, we Cahills would rather fight each other, steal information, and keep each other from getting ahead.
He shifted his weight and winced.
As my cracked rib and black eyes will testify.
But who buried all these hints in the first place?
Amy demanded.
Franklin?
Alistair sipped his espresso.
I don't know, my dear. If I were to guess, I'd say it is a hodgepodge, a collected effort by many Cahills over the centuries. Dear old Grace seems to be the one who wove them all together,
though why or how, I don't know. Whatever the final treasure is, the greatest Cahill mines have gone to a good deal of trouble to hide it. Or perhaps, as in the case of Benjamin Franklin, some of them are trying to lead us toward it. I suppose we will only know for certain when we find the treasure.
We?
Dan said.
I still believe we must have an alliance,
Alistair said.
Uh-uh.
Nellie shook her head.
Don't trust this guy, kiddos. He's too smooth.
Alistair laughed.
And you're an expert on smooth, my teenage babysitter?
Au pair, Nellie corrected.
Alistair looked like he wanted to make another joke at her expense. Then he glanced at her lethal backpack and apparently changed his mind.
The point is, children, our competitors have decided you are the team to beat.
But why us?
Amy demanded. Alistair shrugged.
You've been ahead of the game so far. You have escaped every trap. You are always Grace's favorites.
His eyes glittered like a starving man looking at a Big Mac.
Let's be honest, eh? We all believe Grace gave you inside information. She must have. Tell me what it is, and I can help you.
Dan clenched his fists. He remembered that video of Grace, how stunned he'd felt when she'd announced the contest. Grace should have given them inside information. If she'd really loved them, she wouldn't have left them in the dark. The other teams were after them now because they thought Amy and Dan were Grace's favorites. But apparently Grace hadn't cared about them. They were just another team in this big, cruel game she'd cooked up. The more he thought about it, the more betrayed he felt. He looked at the jade necklace around Amy's neck. He wanted to yank it off and throw it away. His eyes started to burn.
We don't have inside information,
he mumbled.
Come now, my boy, Alistair said. You are in danger. I could protect you. We could search the catacombs together.
We'll search by ourselves, Dan said.
As you wish, my boy. But be aware, the catacombs are huge. There are miles of tunnels. Most aren't even mapped. You can easily get lost down there. Special police patrol it to keep out trespassers. Some of the tunnels are flooded. Others collapse from time to time. Searching for Franklin's clue in the catacombs will be dangerous and futile unless...
He leaned forward and raised his eyebrows.
Unless you do know something you haven't told me. The almanac had a note in the margin. It mentioned coordinates in a box. You wouldn't happen to know what this box might be.
Even if we knew,
Dan said,
we wouldn't tell you.
Amy touched the jade necklace at her collar.
Sorry, Uncle Alistair.
I see. Alistair sat back. I admire your spirit. But what if I were to trade information? I'm sure you are wondering about those notes your mother made. I knew your parents. I could explain a few things.
Dan felt as if the air had turned to glass. He was afraid to move or he might get cut.
What few things?
Alistair smiled like he knew he'd hooked them.
Your mother's interest in the clues, perhaps, or what your father really did for a living.
He was a math professor,
Amy said.
Hmm.
Alistair's smile was so irritating, Dan was tempted to tell Nellie to whack him with the backpack again.
Maybe you'd like to know about the night they died?
The turkey and cheese sandwich churned in Dan's stomach.
What do you know about that?
Many years ago, your mother...
Alistair stopped abruptly, his eyes fixed on something across the street.
Children, we must continue this later. I believe you should look in the catacombs by yourselves. I'll stay behind, as a show of good faith.
What do you mean?
Dan demanded. Alistair pointed with his cane. 100 yards down the street, Ian and Natalie Cabra were pushing through the crowd, hurrying toward the catacombs entrance.
I'll hold them off as long as I can,
Alistair promised.
Now get underground, quickly.